When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
This is News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. And this is Atlanta. The food, the wine, the entertainment, the lifestyle. This is Belinda Skelton's Atlanta Living.
Brought to you this hour by Marietta Plastic Surgery.
And welcome back to Atlanta Living. I'm your host, Belinda Skelton. Well, each year, more than 1 million visitors flock to the Biltmore Estate for the colossal Gilded Age Chateau built by George Vanderbilt in the Blue Ridge Mountains between the years of 1889 and 1895. But Biltmore is the largest home ever built in America, occupies a mere 175,000 square feet, and is larger than three White Houses. Yet the story of the Biltmore and of its people who live there and work there and play there, and the Biltmore's wife, orphan young Edith Dresser, claimed the lineage of the New York's best-known families, and it goes on, and we could talk about it infinity. I am obsessed with the Biltmore House, as I think many of Atlantans and the South are. So I brought in author Denise Kiernan. And she has just written The Last Castle. And Denise, what made you write this fabulous book about the Biltmore?
Well, like you, I am obsessed with Biltmore House and its history. I had actually gone there for the first time when I was a teenager. I'm not from Asheville, but my father, who was in the military, was stationed in South Carolina. And so one weekend, my mom took us up to see the house. I don't need to say how long ago my being a teenager was. We'll just leave that out. And I was struck. I was already a little history nerd, and I was struck by how entering that house was like stepping into a giant time capsule.
Right.
It is amazing, right? You walk through those doors and you go into the tapestry gallery, and the tapestries hanging on those walls are the tapestries that likely would have been hanging on the walls. There are still so many artifacts throughout the entire home that belong to George and Edith and Cornelia Vanderbilt. So it really is like stepping back in time. And of course, the surrounding area, they've still got quite a bit of land around it that is intact. So the gardens that Frederick Law Olmsted designed,
yes,
are there and flourishing. The roads and the paths, it really is like stepping back in time. And when I ended up moving to Asheville, which was a surprise to me later in life, I moved there about 11 years ago. I went back to Biltmore House immediately, and whenever friends come, I take them there, of course. And I'm always surprised, especially my friends from other parts of the United States, how curious they are after we're done with the tour. They want to know more. They did, and many times had no idea that this was the largest house ever in the United States.
Well, let me ask you there. So it was the largest house in the United States. Is it still the largest house? I mean, we have some pretty darn big houses.
We have got some monstrous houses in this country. And here is what eventually pushed me over the edge to saying, like, I really, really, really want to do this book. Several years back, there was a documentary called Queen of Versailles. And it was about a couple in Florida that were building what they called the largest home in America. This was in Florida. This was in like 2012 mm-hmm. or something. This home was going to be a measly 90,000 square feet.
Oh, please.
I mean, come on. No, but
don't even bother.
What was interesting to me was how the media and the press picked this up. In fact, I went to, you know, the prognosticator of prognosticators, Google, and put in largest home in America. I did this within the last month, And sure enough, there was a picture of the wife of this real estate developer in Florida. And it was said, you know, nicknamed Versailles in Florida, was going to be 90,000 square feet. It was in The Guardian. It was on Huffington Post. It was on all these places. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my gosh. A, they didn't finish. And B, it would have been about half the size of Biltmore House. And not that this book is about, you know, the trivia of Biltmore.
Right.
That is merely a jumping off point. But I did think it was absolutely fascinating that that aspect of Biltmore remained still somewhat unknown to folks, because it really does make it all the more amazing that it still endures to this day in one piece.
In one piece. Bingo. And in perfect condition. And so it was built between 1889 and 1895. And during the Gilded Age, the financial crisis, the jazz era, but it had to have a railroad created and started to get the materials to the site.
Yes. So so the book starts with the early days of Edith Vanderbilt in New York and abroad before she meets George. It goes through the building of the house and then does get into the Progressive Era and the Jazz Age and World Wars. But during the actual construction in those late 1880s, early 1890s, transporting materials to the work site was becoming quite difficult because, of course, they're using horses,
right,
and things of that matter. So George just decided there was the nearby crossroads at the time was called Best. And there was a junction there that some people referred to as the Asheville Junction. And he built a rail spur, a 3-mile rail spur, which at a cost of $80,000 in 1890 or so, to bring materials over to the work site. And it also brought workers. They would just load up the train cars with, you know, masons or bricklayers or whoever else was going in there. And then that rail spur went right into what is now the beautiful, beautiful Esplanade, long green park-like area in front of Biltmore House. So if you can imagine, if you go to Biltmore House now, you have this gorgeous Esplanade and this fountain in front of this spectacular structure. When it was being built, it was just, you know, booming construction noises and scaffolding and bricks and limestone and wooden derricks and everything all over that Esplanade while they were trying to get this gigantic home built.
Well, he also had to have workers. So at the edge of the property, he also built a town.
That's right.
For the workers to live and for have a community for them to be in. So he built, while this is going on, built a town.
This is part of what was going on during the construction of the house, was the construction of what we now refer to as Biltmore Village. And so beyond what would be the entrance gate to the main estate, Olmsted and Hunt began to lay out a small village. Now, the original village was actually temporary. It was temporary wooden structures, mostly for the folks who were going to work there at the at Biltmore House during construction. Eventually, those temporary wooden structures were taken down. Lovely streets and greens were laid out. All Souls Cathedral was erected, and those temporary homes were replaced with these lovely pebble-dash stucco homes laid out on these streets. They became still were homes often rented by employees, but they were also there were shops and there were offices, and of course All Souls Cathedral became the real heart of the community there, the community that was just outside the main entrance to Biltmore House.
And the workers became like family to the Vanderbilts.
I found myself very touched by the charitable nature shared by both George and Edith Vanderbilt. Edith in particular, I love her. She had such a beautiful personal touch with people. It's one thing to be charitable and sit behind your big wrought iron gates and write your checks. It is another thing to be a lady hopping onto a horse to bring baskets of supplies to an ailing employee.
Right.
I mean, these are very, very different things. And I don't begrudge people who donate money by any stretch of the imagination. But when you consider the time, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, mm-hmm. and how, you know, ladies were supposed to behave, I think it really meant a lot to people that...
And that was quite a trek from the,
yes.
from the house down to the community, down to the village.
Especially on a horse.
Right.
So she was just very, very present. George gave a lot to the community as well, but there was just something... something very special about Edith. And also, you know, they were involved in so many of the family's celebrations. They always had a massive, if they were in town, they had a massive Christmas party for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Edith kept track of everybody who got gifts so that she didn't repeat gifts from one year to another.
Amazing.
When Cornelia came along, you know, they didn't keep her secluded. There were, you know, birthday parties and school regularly involved the children of workers and local kids just living beyond the gates. So I really found that quite inspiring.
And this house that's just beyond belief, you know, over the top as far as the construction and the size, it had modern conveniences
yes.
that you wouldn't think would be possible during that time of plumbing, indoor plumbing.
Indoor, lots of indoor plumbing.
I mean, as far as going as far as a pool with underwater lighting.
A complete, very substantial indoor pool with functioning underwater lighting.
I mean, this was 1889.
They started, yeah. So, late 1800s. They had electric call systems so that you could buzz for, you know, a snack or just, you know, call a footman electronically from most of the main rooms in the house. You could call also from the pool area.
Mm-hmm.
They had hand crank dumbwaiters. They also had electric dumbwaiters.
Mm-hmm.
At the time the house was being built, rivalry between Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison was going on between alternating electric current and direct electric current.
Right.
So George and Richard Morris Hunt just thought, well, let's put in both.
Wow.
So it was astounding. It was astounding what they accomplished technologically in a home that's still visually. So it was amazing that this house with such incredible technological advances, looking at it, just harkened back to, you know, the heights of the Victorian age.
And it also had a bowling alley of all things.
Oh, yes. It has had a bowling alley. The recreational options at Biltmore were incredible because in many ways it was designed for that. It was designed as a country escape for family and friends.
And they entertained a lot, and we're going to touch on that when we come back. We're going to take a break when we come back. More with Denise Kiernan and The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. You're listening to Atlanta Living only on News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. And welcome back to Atlanta Living. I'm your host, Belinda Skelton, and we're talking about The Last Castle, and that would be the Biltmore Estate in Asheville, North Carolina. And I have in the studio with me Denise Kiernan. She's the author of The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. And so we talked about the royalty and the visitors, and they did entertain a lot, the Vanderbilts, in the Biltmore. So name drop a little bit.
They did. That's right. Get ready for all the names to fall on the floor. George did want a place to go to with his mother. He was very close with his mother and also with his family members and friends. But their family members and friends were quite an interesting group of people. Author Edith Wharton was a guest at the house on a couple occasions. Author Henry James was a guest at the house. Teddy Roosevelt stopped by to visit the house. President McKinley stopped by to visit the house. We have, let's see, who else? John Muir came by to examine the forestry activities there. It was just sort of a nonstop kind of parade of really interesting
people. And when we say they stopped by, this is for like a week or two, because
with some of the guests, such as Paul Lester Ford, who is a very, very well-known author of the time, some of these folks were invited to stay for a couple. Some people, the presidents obviously are usually on a fairly tight schedule. But the president's daughter, Alice Roosevelt, was also a visitor at Biltmore, and she stayed a little longer than her father was able to. But friends like Paul Lester Ford or, Edith's sisters, Henry James, they would stay for often weeks at a time. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's quite a trek to
Why
get
not?
There. So, they stay for a while.
Absolutely.
Okay, there was a lot of love loss going on at the Biltmore also.
Well, I think it's one of the things that I wanted to get across in The Last Castle was the incredible resilience, especially of Edith. Without giving too much away, she had to endure quite a bit of personal loss in her life. She endured a lot of personal loss early in her life, and then that continued mm-hmm. on in her adulthood. And I was always amazed at how she managed to keep things together, look for solutions, move on to whatever the next challenge was. And I think it was because of her tenacity and her dedication to always kind of finding a new way to move forward that Biltmore House continues to exist in the state it's in today.
Right. She was a very strong presence in the house.
Absolutely.
Okay, Denise Kiernan, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. The book is a must-read, The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. Continued success.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Atlanta Living only on News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB.
This is News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. And this is Atlanta. The food, the wine, the entertainment, the lifestyle. This is Belinda Skelton's Atlanta Living.
Brought to you this hour by Marietta Plastic Surgery.
And welcome to Atlanta Living. I'm your host, Belinda Skelton. Everybody loves a good barbecue or a good cookout on the grill, but I have the master of both. I have Stephen Reichlin in the studio with me, James Beard Award winner, IACP Award winner, PBS star, Barbecue Hall of Famer, Steve Reichlin, pioneering, bringing the art of global live fire cooking techniques and flavors to American grillers. Thank you so much for spending a little time with us on Atlanta Living, Stephen.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Okay. Now, can you please explain to me, because I'm going to grill or I'm going to barbecue in the same reference, and people tell me that's not the case.
Two very different processes. So grilling is a high heat, direct live fire method that you would use on a quick cooking tender food, like a steak, a burger, a chop, a fish fillet, etc. True barbecue is done at a much lower temperature for a much longer period of time. The mantra here is low and slow, and true barbecue always involves wood smoke. Now, with grilling, you may or may not add chips or chunks to your fire to generate wood smoke. It's not barbecue if it doesn't have wood smoke.
Okay. Now, what age would you say that you started your passion for grilling and smoking and barbecuing?
Well, it's funny. Like all people that possess a Y chromosome, I've always thought of myself as an expert, and when I lived in Boston for 20 years, I would chip the ice off of my grill in the winter and grill. But I didn't really kind of get involved with it professionally until 1994, when I started work on the book that would become the Barbecue Bible. That came out in 1998. And it was only when I really started to research the books that I realized how little I actually knew about the field of live fire cooking.
But you were already on PBS and you had a show by that time.
No, actually the show came afterwards. So Barbecue Bible came out in 1998 and
okay.
How to Grill, which was the big bestseller with the 1,000 step-by-step color photographs,
came out in 2002, and the TV show, the first TV show, Barbecue University, came out shortly thereafter.
Okay.
That's a show named for a school that I run at the Broadmoor Resort in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
I still run that.
Okay, very good. So this book, this latest book, Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades, based and butters and glazes too, this is so important because you can have a good piece of meat on the grill and it can taste wonderful, but you can up it up a notch with the marinades and the grill and the sauces that you put pair with it. But this is where I get completely lost.
Well, absolutely. You can not only do you up the basic steak or chop or ribs, but you also give them your personal touch and an ethnic identity. So you could start with the same chicken breast, and depending on whether you use a Japanese marinade or a Moroccan marinade or an Argentinian spice rub or Texas spice rub, you can give it a completely different identity.
Now, are these spices and rubs and things that you have created and made up the spice ingredients yourself?
Well, many I've made up myself, like my basic barbecue rub, which is a 4-4 rub, equals to part salt, pepper, paprika, and brown sugar. But as in all my books, the first thing I do when I go to write a new book is I pack a suitcase, I start traveling. Because I'm looking for ideas and flavor combinations from all over Planet Barbecue. So in this book, in addition to my own recipes, there are also classic marinades that I've met from world-renowned grill masters, pit masters, restaurants, etc. But even those are kind of always refracted through my test kitchen and my way of doing things.
Well, you know, I've seen barbecue go from just the good old barbecue stand that's got the pit out back and smoking. It's made its way into really fancy restaurants on some gourmet menus.
It's pretty incredible, isn't it? You know, you have a great place down there in Atlanta called King and Duke.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously the focal point, the focal point of that restaurant is their massive Grillworks wood-burning grill. But this is a major trend all over the country and, dare I say, the world, which is people using the world's oldest cooking method, which is grilling, but applying it in a fine dining fine dining setting to fine dining foods.
Well, we also have a restaurant called the Pig and the Pearl, and you know, you can get some elaborate barbecue dishes that have some very snooty surroundings, and it takes on a whole different taste and meaning when, you know, you're not putting the napkin in your shirt tail anymore.
What I love about grilling is that it's so utterly democratic. I mean, it can be down and dirty, it can be fancy and elegant, and it can be everywhere in between.
Well, let's talk about some of these rubs, because we have a weekend coming up here, and your book has over 200 recipes. And if you're tired of grilled chicken as I am, I mean, if I eat just another plain grilled chicken, I'm going to commit Harry Carey with a butter knife. So what can I do to my grilled chicken or any other cuts of meat to just really amp them up? What are some of the recipes in the book?
Well, let's see. You could start with what I call the only marinade you'll ever need, which is a basic Mediterranean herb marinade flavored with garlic, fresh herbs, lemon juice, and olive oil.
Oh.
And what I like about that recipe is it's completely customizable. So fresh dill is in season, but fresh tarragon isn't. Use dill. If you want to take it in an oriental direction, use sesame oil instead of olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
Use rice vinegar instead of fresh lemon juice. If you want to go more Caribbean, add chilies, add fresh lime juice. So that's a great place to start. I was born in Japan, and I guess I always have a natural predisposition and affection for Asian flavors. So I might take that chicken, I might give it a Japanese yakitori marinade and glaze, or I might give it a Vietnamese lemongrass marinade, or a Malaysian coconut milk curry marinade. You know, the point is, I guess for me, I think of this book, you know, if barbecue were fashion, this book is all about the accessories. And we know how important the accessories are to the overall look and great taste of a dish.
Oh, absolutely. Now, what is the difference in a dry rub and a wet rub?
Okay, a dry rub is a powder comprised of spices and seasonings. So one example would be like a Dalmatian rub, which is equal parts coarse salt and cracked black peppercorns, grated on brisket. A wet rub straddles midway between a marinade, which is completely wet, and a dry rub, which is completely dry. So it's a spice paste. It's a thick paste that you spread on a meat. Marinades and wet rubs, by the way, are great for lean meats because they add moisture and fat. Dry rubs are great for fatty meats because the fat's already there. So, you know, you just want to add that layer of flavor.
Now, how long do you recommend that the rub stay on the meat before you put it on the grill or the smoker?
Well, it depends on what you're marinating, and it also depends on the thickness of the cut. With a rub, you can sprinkle it on right before grilling, in which case the rub acts like a seasoned salt, or you can apply it the night before and let the meat cure in the refrigerator. And in that instance, the salt, the sugar, and the rub actually do transform the texture and flavor of the meat.
Okay. Okay. Good words to live by. And this is all in your book, Steve Reichland, Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. And it's a great thing to have on hand and a great resource to have next to your barbecue and your grill. Now, when you're basting or you're glazing, is this something that you recommend doing it from the very beginning, or is this a finishing thing
well,
that you do?
Okay, so basting and glazing, that brings us to sort of the second opportunity to put on flavor. The first, of course, is when the meat is raw, and that's when you use a rub or a marinade. Basting and glazing, I like to wait until the meat is about halfway cooked. It's a simple health safety, food safety reason. And that is, I don't like to touch a basting brush to raw meat, then put it back in the pot with basting in case, you know, there are any impurities or microbes. But if you wait until the food is lightly browned on both sides, then you start basting. You're basting on cooked meat, so you never have to worry about cross-contaminating your basting mixture.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. And what are some of your favorite baste or glazes that you like to use, if you'll let the cat out of the bag?
Oh, sure. Well, one simple one we use all the time, you melt butter in it, you fry finely chopped or thinly sliced garlic and chopped fresh cilantro. I mean, it's just as basic as it could be, but if you're grilling shrimp, if you're grilling seafood, that just gives you so much flavor.
You know what I love is I'm looking through your cookbook. I love how simple your glazes and your recipes are. Nothing is very complicated. Nothing is more than, I judge things by how many columns they take up. If it's a two column, then I'm out of there. It's too complicated.
Okay. Well, you know, in general, grilling is pretty simple and straightforward. Now, there are some barbecue sauces that, you know, involve a number of ingredients, but sometimes barbecue is supposed to be complicated, particularly when men get involved. You know, I think we tend to like to overcomplicate things.
Just to say you did.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Nah, but, you know, a barbecue sauce there, you're kind of thinking about deep layers of flavor and sort of playing to every section of your tongue, every section of your taste bud. But in general, these recipes are very quick and easy to do. Look, we live in a time, you know, in an age when nobody has... time is tight for all of us.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Steven Reichland. He's the author of Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. Some of his former books have been The Barbecue Bible, How to Grill, Project Smoke, New York Times bestsellers. You can grab them at any of your local bookstores or Amazon.com. We're going to take a break. We're going to be talking more barbecue, grilling, and smoking on Atlanta Living right after this.
More of Belinda Skelton's Atlanta Living.
and welcome back to Atlanta Living. I'm your host, Belinda Skelton. We have on the line Steve Reichlin. He's the author of Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. But in his library, he has Barbecue Bible, Project Smoke, How to Grill. He's a PBS star, James Beard Award winner, Barbecue Hall of Fame. You've seen him all over the TV and publications when it comes to barbecue and grilling and smoking. So I have to ask you, how important is brining when it comes to the success of your meat project?
Well, brining is really gaining in popularity, and a brine is simply a mixture of salt and water. Sometimes you add sugar to make it a little sweet and salty, and sometimes if you're curing bacon, for example, or pastrami, you would add a curing salt, like Prague powder, curing salt number one or number two, or sometimes it's called sodium nitrite. And these are naturally occurring products, and what they do, what a brine does is it makes meat more moist. It allows the meat to absorb more liquid and retain more liquid. So that's a very important function. In the case of something like bacon or pastrami, it also is responsible for that distinctive pink color and that distinctive, in the case of pastrami, garlicky, spicy flavor. Brining is a great technique for people to know about if you're cooking chicken breasts or pork chops or other foods that have a natural tendency to dry out on the grill.
Okay, how long should you brine the meat?
Well, again, it depends on size. If it's something like shrimp, 15 minutes will do the trick. If it's something like a brisket or a pork belly to make bacon, you know, a brine could go for 4 to 5 days.
Okay, say your average chicken breast.
Average chicken breast, you're going to want to brine it for about 2 hours.
2 hours, that's it?
Yeah, it's real quick. I mean, you know, remember, chicken breast is thin. And you'll be amazed at just a simple brine, how much difference that makes when you actually take the chicken off the grill.
Okay, great. And it makes such a difference in the moisture content and the taste of that chicken.
Absolutely.
Okay, we're going to take another break, fill you in on Atlanta's news, weather, and traffic. When we come back, we're going to give you more tips and information on barbecue sauces, rubs, and marinades, base, butters, and glazes, too, from Steve Reichlin. And you're listening to Atlanta Living, only on News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.